One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Hey, hey there, friends. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale. As always, joining me in studio, my good friend, my partner in crime, the Filio, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to Expanded Perspectives, especially if this is your first time joining us here on the show. You're going to have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun. We talk about strange sighting, crazy stories. We get into UFOs, cryptozoology, ancient history, alternative history. And then things, of course, that have to do with DARPA and robots, and they're taking over all the planet, right?
Here we go.
Yeah, man, I'm doing good. How about you?
You sound way better, bud.
I feel better. I told you, man, I hit those antibiotics. I got some rest. Not as much rest as I probably needed, but just I kind of chilled out. I feel amazing compared to last Wednesday, when we recorded Thursday's show?
Yeah. It sounded like you were going to die. He wasn't too happy after it was all over with because he was like, man, I'm going to record. I'm going to take some meds. I'm going to go watch the Stars game. Well, they lost that game. So I picked him up and I called him the next morning and I'm like, hey, bud. He's like, what's up? First thing I say, that was you bad luck. He's like, don't talk to me. Don't bring it up. So this is the first time I bring it up in almost a week. So he was the bad luck piece. I hope everybody is doing wonderful. We have a really fun show, I think, planned. At least for us, it was fun. It was great digging into this story that I looked into here. Before we get into that, though, of course, we always jump into the news, and Kyle has got some interesting news. I got some stuff I'm going to share with him I haven't told him about yet, but he was touching on something. What were you telling me about a reef? I'm not sure what you were saying.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. Check this out. There's a new gigantic reef that was found just at the end of the Amazon River that nobody knew about. It's incredible that it's escaped notice for so long, but scientists have just discovered a massive 9,500 square kilometer reef system at the mouth of the Amazon River.
And this thing just was, nobody found it. It's just, how do you just all of a sudden go, oh, we didn't know that was there?
Right? I guess just nobody was really paying any attention. You know, the water's kind of murky around this. They just didn't know.
I get it if it was 100 yards. You know, it's a little 100-yard reef. I get that. But how much? 9,500 square kilometers.
Yeah, right? Now, when we typically hear about, you know, reefs, we typically think of colorful corals and crystal clear tropical waters, which is probably why nobody ever bothered to look for one at the outflow of the world's largest river. Now, discharging up to 300,000 cubic meters of sediment-loaded water every second, the Amazon River generates a thick, smog-like plume that darkens the surrounding seafloor, depressing light and oxygen levels. So you can imagine the surprise of these scientists who discovered a large reef system built mainly of sponges and algae sitting just beneath it. Now, to be fair, folks, having been finding corals and other reef-building organisms near the mouth of the Amazon for years, It wasn't until Thompson, who's a scientist, and his colleagues began an extensive field survey back in 2012 that anybody had any clue at how widespread this new ecosystem was. Now, of course, it says it's dominated by sponges and crust-forming red algae, but it stretches 600 miles long. And it's, you know, it's a shallow, it's an outer continental shelf there that goes all the way from French Guiana border all the way down to Brazil. And it says because the reef cuts across the mouth of the Amazon, environmental conditions change dramatically along its length. In the north, the river plume casts a very heavy shadow, rendering both light and oxygen. And so those life forms that are on that part of the reef are much different than the ones that are further south, where the water's clearer, sunnier, and more, well, aerated. This in turn results in a distinct difference in the ecological communities along this reef. And they said that we're just now starting to explore it. And of course, much like all the other reefs on planet Earth, they fear that this reef might face the threats caused by humans, offshore oil drilling, gas drilling, industrial fisheries, and of course, climate change. I mean, you've been aware of this, the Great Barrier Reef off Australia and also in Indonesia. There's been these huge bleaching of the coral reefs around that area, which has been decimating them. It's terrible. But, you know, much like we talk about the rise and fall of human civilizations, I believe there's the rise and fall of these giant coral reefs, you know, where this one's declining when the polar ice caps melt and the water rises, there's going to be new ones springing up somewhere else. You know what I mean?
That's true.
So, you know, it's sad but that they're dying off, but it's pretty cool that this coral reef has been there. It's just a different type and that no one really knew. I guess no one was really looking at it in that dirty water. But, man, have you ever seen some of the reefs, though, in the Great Barrier Reef or, like, in Indonesia and stuff? Man, some of that stuff is so cool.
I don't need to see that.
Yeah?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I don't need to see that stuff. It's in the salt water. I'll just leave it. I don't need to
look at it. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
I don't need to see that stuff. I dang sure don't need to go see this one when it's just the murky water where you can't see a foot in front of you. I don't need to see that. I'm good. Trust me. I'm real good. Yeah. Hey, I got something for you that you're going to really enjoy, and it may kind of, I can't say that it lends credibility to the Sasquatch argument, but this is an interesting little twist here. This comes from New Scientist. Colin Barris reports on this. A 21-million-year-old fossil in North America, or is North America's first monkey.
Yeah. What?
It was a monkey.
So there used to be monkeys here.
Yeah, it says that. Look, he claims the monkey started all about 3 million years ago. There says there's a very epic ecological struggle of the animals of North and South America were actually battling it out. Now, listen to this. They said there was a fossil from Panama suggests that the opening salvo actually came 18 million years earlier than thought, and it was done by a monkey invader. Now, they said there was a thing called a Panama Isthmus that's generally dated to about 3 million years ago, and it's a land connection that was between North and South America for the first time. And they say once it formed, there was animals from the north, like horses and deer and saber-toothed cats. They all came south. And then southern species, ground sloths, armadillos, and even terror birds, went north. And so these battles were dubbed the Great American Interchange. And they believed it raged for generations. And they also believed that many species were lost. So you have to imagine like saber-toothed cats feeding on these ground sloths, right?
Right, yeah.
Feeding on these armadillos. There may have been other species that we don't know anything about. What they say now is that it seems that the very first animal to cross continents did so long before this isthmus even emerged. Jonathan Bloch is a University of Florida in Gainesville.
Florida man.
He's been studying this. And he and his colleagues studied a 21-million-year-old sediment in this whole area in the Panama that was deposited on the North American side before this isthmus formed. They found 7 teeth belonging to a South American monkey. Now, Blutch says the researchers were initially stumped by the teeth, which clearly belonged to the 21-million-year-old deposits and weren't a latter addition. Now, this is what he says. How could they possibly be those of a monkey, given what almost seems like a law at this point? There are no monkeys in North America prior to the Great American Interchange. But a careful examination confirmed the fossil's affinities. He said, unambiguously, these are teeth of a South American monkey that somehow managed to do what no other mammal could do at the time, get across the Central American Seaway. This is what Bloch said. He said at the time, the seaway separating North and South America was at least 160 kilometers wide. Now, the monkey is a Panama cebus. It's an ancient member of one of the 5 families of monkey found in the Americas. This includes the capuchins and squirrel monkeys, because they're cute little, you know, they're fun little monkeys. But it wasn't the only animal that crossed between North and South America, but it's by far what they say is the oldest. He says, prior to this discovery, the oldest fossil evidence for mammalian dispersal from South to North America is a 9-million-year-old sloth.
Yeah.
Get a load of that. Now, the discovery is absolutely astounding. Now, this is Richard Kay at Duke University in North Carolina. He says, a 21-million-year-old fossil monkey appearing in Central America is extraordinary and a bolt from the blue. But Kay does go on to say that he says that the idea needs to be developed and fleshed out to be more persuasive. So they could be right, but it's early in the days about how they got there. Now, the first thing when I thought about this was, look, that's cool. They found some teeth. But you know how you always want to go, well, how would it have got there this much earlier before this formed? Well, he said something that I caught into this whole thing, and I want to run this by you right quick. He talks about terror birds. Now, I know those were large ground-dwelling birds. Is
terrifying.
What they call the terror
birds. Have you ever seen those things?
But I'm also thinking about large birds of prey that could fly.
Yeah.
Well, let's say that there were some land masses in between where these two connected. And maybe these large birds flew from landmass to landmass. Let's just say maybe this fossil was a dropped piece of meat.
Yeah,
what if it was
be.
A bird that was flying back and it just so happened to drop it?
What if
and
it was
just something that was eaten and then the remains were left
there? What if it was like an animal salesperson had this thing caged and was bringing it north to trade because it was an exotic species?
That's an awful long time ago, but maybe so.
You know.
What if? Yeah, what if?
Who knows?
Yeah, so I mean, it is interesting. I know it doesn't have a big tie-in with anything cryptozoological because they know it's a small monkey and it was years ago and all that stuff, but it is neat that they're actually studying the sediments before these two pieces of land connected, where they bleed when it hit, it kind of washed this up. So at least they're looking into some other older stuff.
Well, sticking with the terror bird, I just saw another article real quick recently about how they found another dinosaur, which they had thought was, you know, looked like a reptile, looked like a lizard, whatever. And they've been finding muscles where they think it had the power to operate its quills, that it too had feathers. So it's starting to really look like, folks, that, you know, when they used to say that birds were really the ancestors of dinosaurs, I mean, dinosaurs are the ancestors of birds, you don't know how true that was.
Yeah,
it's beginning to look like a lot of the dinosaurs had feathers. And have you ever seen the representation of, like, what T-Rex looks like?
Yes.
When they cover it in feathers?
Yeah.
It's still scary looking
to me. It's a giant, scary, freakish bird. Yes.
So I wonder how long until they start redoing all the children's books where they're like, look, folks, these things, you know, they really had feathers.
Well, what I want to know is, okay, let's say that comes out, right? Let's say it comes out to where it becomes to pass and becomes law that they know now that dinosaurs had feathers, at least the majority of them, let's say. Well, then what happens to all these movies? I mean, like
Jurassic
Park? The newest Jurassic Park. does it fully become a joke at that point? You're like, look at this. Come on now.
This is when those idiots used to think they didn't have feathers.
Yeah, before they knew that. Yeah, 50 years from now, it's all going to have feathers.
Yeah.
I don't know why it took the reptilian blend. I guess because it's supposed to look like a giant lizard. Dinosaur looks like a giant lizard. That's the whole idea behind it. But they're finding more and more and more where they believe, that they're covered in feathers.
Yeah, well, check this out. Over on Phantoms and Monsters, Lon Strickler just posted this interesting story about a dwarf or a leprechaun sighting that happened back in Detroit in August of 2013. Now, I know how you love these stories of dwarves and leprechauns. It's pretty cool. Check this out. I would like to tell you about an experience that I and my friend had back in Detroit, Michigan, on Saturday, August 3rd, 2013. It was a typical Saturday night. My friend and me were hanging out around the neighborhood and not really doing much at all. Well, we decided to go for a walk. We decided to go over to Perrin Park, smoke a little weed, and just hang out. And this was about 9:30 p.m. We walked over and found a bench that was a bit out of the way where it would provide us with some privacy to let us smoke in peace. And at about 11 p.m., we decided to leave the park, and that's when we heard some rustling in the trees behind us. It was then followed by what sounded like laughter. Tiny, high-pitched, almost childlike laughter. We thought at first it must have been someone messing with us and stood up and yelled out, "Cut it out! We're not falling for it!" This was met with more laughter and, of course, more rustling from the trees. Suddenly, two small people jumped out of the tree and almost floated down to the ground in front of us. We jumped back when we saw these two small people, almost yelling from the sudden surprise that their sudden appearance had given us. These two small people both looked male. They couldn't have been more than 4 feet tall. They were stocky and looked like they were wearing green three-piece suits. They looked almost like they were wearing leprechaun costumes and carrying what looked like walking sticks. My friend later told me that they looked almost like Hornswoggle from the WWE, which I had to agree that they really did. They looked at us for about 5 seconds. No sound, no movement. We were totally and completely freaked out and decided to get out of there as quickly as possible. The moment we moved and started backing away, these two things jumped at us, covering the 6 or 7 feet between us in a single instant. They were on top of us, screaming loudly as they bit, scratched, and hit us with the sticks that they were carrying. They were screaming in such an inhuman way. It sounded like an animal in distress crossed with a feral human. They were ripping at our clothes, swinging at our heads with these sticks that they were carrying, all the while laughing and screaming at the top of their lungs. My friend and I were overpowered, and all we could do was try to get away from these creatures and protect our heads from these sticks that they were swinging. Almost as quickly as it started, it ended, and they leaped off of us and bolted toward the trees and disappeared with nothing more than maniacal laughter. We got up and sprinted home as fast as we could go. We got home to my house and quickly shut the door and bolted it shut before we bothered to try and breathe easy and figure out what had just happened to us. Both my friend and I were both busted up pretty bad with a collection of scratches and scrapes. We stayed in the rest of the night. We were hurting so much the next day that it was impossible for us to move without groaning in pain. Now, we have never seen anything like these two creatures before and could not come up with an explanation as to what it was that attacked us that night. I know that this sounds incredible, and you might try to dismiss it as fantasy made up by two crazy men. And we know that we've told the story that we were there to smoke weed, but I'm telling you, we've done that numerous times and we've never seen anything like this. I have no idea what we encountered that night. So what do you think of that? I mean, you could always say, well, yeah, they must have been hallucinating, but how would you hallucinate that? And if it was too just like little
people? That's some
people,
pretty strong weed, right? If that's what that is.
Well, and the funny thing is if you look into it, there are actual numerous stories in the Detroit, Michigan area of like leprechaun and like these little
I think of
demon
Dwindy.
Sightings.
Dwindies is the minute I think of.
I'm
man.
Telling
when you're
you.
You're talking about the walking sticks. It's the first thing I thought of.
It is bizarre. I mean, yeah. You know, I have no idea if it was real or not. It's an interesting story. I love that. I'll put links to it in the show notes if you want to go over to Phantoms and Monsters and check it out. Be the judge of it for yourself. I know that I love these Dwindy stories, these leprechaun stories. It's creepy, right? I mean, just to imagine to be in a park and then they always seem ill-tempered. I don't know why the leprechauns always seem ill-tempered.
Little man syndrome.
Yeah, maybe
what it is. They're aggravated.
They're maybe aggravated. They were mad because those two weren't sharing, you know. They were Bogart, you
right?
know? I mean, come on.
Don't hide it, divide it.
Yeah, I mean, come on, man.
And then he got mad. Yeah, nothing like getting your butt whooped by a bunch of Dwindies
right?
with walking sticks in the middle of a park.
I can't imagine.
You think they lost their buzz?
I think they did, yeah.
Well, I got you one here. Since I know that, you know, you brought me the little Dwindy, I'm going to talk to you with one that happened in New Mexico back in 1990. It was a dog man encounter. This
oh,
actually
yeah,
was
I love
reported
these.
To Coast to Coast. A fellow named Edward, he says, I'm 45 now, and this was back in 1990. He said, I was driving a friend of mine from Long Island out to Tucson, Arizona. We're coming through the mountains into Alamogordo, New Mexico, and this dog runs out. I'm like, oh no, I'm going to hit it. So I stopped the truck. Now I'm pulling a U-Haul trailer with my manual Toyota pickup. I said, man, it's close. I look down, and he comes up to the driver's side door. Now, I know I had plenty of rest because I've been sleeping all day as my friend had been driving during the day, and then I would drive all night. So I wake my buddy up. I say, Darren, wake up and look at this. Well, the dog gets up, and it had short front legs like a dingo, he says, but the eyes were glowing, and dingoes are in Australia. They're not in the Southwest out in the desert. But anyway, he comes up. So I roll my window down a little bit, and I said, no, and it's because something wasn't right. So I locked the door. I pushed it down with my elbow. And then I reached over with my right hand and rolled the window up. And he starts scratching at the window and then literally trying to open the door. So he stands completely up, stood up on his hind legs, and was trying to lift the door handle like it knew what it was doing. And I start yelling, "Darren, wake up." So he wakes up and he looks over. He says, "What the hell is that?" About that time, I drop her into first gear and start rolling up a hill. And I'm like, "Man, I don't know what the hell that was, but that's crazy." And I look again as it reaches the door again on the truck and starts trying to open it. If I didn't lock it in time, I'm pretty sure it would have opened the door. Now, I'll never forget that. And I was 21 or 20 at the time, and I'm 45 now. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. So what do you think about that one?
Man, I don't know. You know, it sounds like a lot of these stories where the dog man always, you know, when you see Sasquatch, lots of times the thing's crossing the road. It doesn't seem like it wants to be bothered by anybody. It's like, "Oh, crap, I've been seen. I'm out of here." Where the dog man always seems like it's trying to get in the cabin you're in. It's trying to get in the car you're in. It you know what I mean? It just always seems like it's more confrontational.
Well, I don't want to poo on this story, but I'm going to say this. When I read the story and I thought about it, look, that's a heck of a story like you're talking about. And he said, you know, its eyes are glowing. It stood up. It's got short front legs. Could it simply have been a large dog that just reared up on the side of the truck that was a friendly large dog and scratched on the side of the truck or something, and somebody completely overreacts? You're freaked out. Maybe you were tired. Maybe, you know, just because you sleep during the day and you're driving all that, maybe you're tired. Maybe you had a little bit to drink. I'm not saying that's what happened. But what I'm saying is there another explanation for what this thing could have been?
Well, you're definitely right. I mean, a dog can stand up and get on the side of a car. That happens all the time, right? You come home, they're just excited to see you.
Well, if you also ever, and because it's happened to me, like you're out at night and there's a light on in your truck and every other lights are off, like you're out there, maybe you're, you know, pig hunting, or maybe you're just parked somewhere and that little bit of glow is reflecting off the glass on your window and you think you see something outside.
Right.
You know, you're like, "Wait a second," you kind of got to roll and you got to start trying to find where that
light. Its eyes are glowing.
Yeah. Well, maybe it was the brake lights that was shining in the animal's eyes, you know, that makes them glow, like if you hit them with a spotlight or headlights or something like, I don't know. I'm just thinking of some other stuff. Like I said, I don't want to say there's no dog men, because definitely there's been some encounters of dog men. This one was very interesting. The way he said what got to me was it seemed like it knew what to do with the door handle. Like it was reaching and trying to open the door.
That's what it sounds like, right?
That's what he said. But like I said, could it be a coincidence?
Absolutely.
I think it could be that too, because he doesn't give any description of if he saw its eyes were glowing, but you can't tell me about its face. It doesn't tell me about its height. He's talking about being in a Toyota pickup and pulling a U-Haul trailer. So yeah. I'm not knowing, is this a Tacoma or is this a Tundra? You know, what are we talking about as far as truck size? We're talking about back in 1990. I'm going that it's a Tacoma.
Yeah.
Is what I'm going.
It could even be the old ones like Steppets used to drive.
Yeah, could be short. It could be a small truck, you know, so then it's not a huge dog leaning up against it. I don't know. There's a lot of other questions. I thought the story is amazing. It's a very creepy story because it always seems to happen at dark, out in the desert.
Yeah.
There's some really strange things. I'm not saying none of this is not real, folks. I'm just my mind trying to think about to go, could it be something else that maybe somebody overreacted with?
Very possible. Did you see this? Hillary Clinton is certainly not hiding the fact that she's really interested in UFOs, as she has pointed out on numerous times in her bid to take up residence again in the White House. And among her many campaign stops this week, the former New York senator paid a visit to the senior center on Monday in East Harlem. And while there, she sat down with a local radio station, Power 105.1 FM's Radio Breakfast Club, and they engaged her and they asked her about it several times, what she's going to do. If she wins the presidency, will she talk about UFOs and try to find out what's behind them? Check this out.
If you become president, are you really going to tell the truth about UFOs? Because I'm
am.
A big extraterrestrial.
Are you a big guy?
Huge. I saw a flying saucer when I was in third.
He actually got attacked.
South Carolina?
In South Carolina.
He got abducted by aliens.
And he has some marks on his shins from them.
I think I've been abducted a few times, but are you going to tell the truth about aliens?
Thanks, Olas. We're not going to the White House now. Thanks.
No.
She promised.
I did. Oh, yeah. No, these are two separate issues. You definitely are coming. I have said I want to open the files as much as we can. I mean, if there's some huge national security thing and I can't get agreement to open them, I won't. But I do want to open them because I'm interested.
Do you believe?
I don't know. I want to see what the information shows, right?
Yeah.
But there are enough stories out there that I don't think everybody is just sitting, you know, in their kitchen making them up. I think that people see things. What they see, I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we've got to try to, you know, give people information. I believe in that.
So that's pretty cool. I mean, I like the way she says that even she doesn't believe that everyone is just sitting around in their kitchens making all this stuff up. It's kind of like, seems like the same thing we're thinking, that there has to be something behind everybody's sightings, you know, and she's going to look into it. Now, of course, everybody's going to say, well, you know, she'll never get to the bottom. She'll be just assassinated if she tries to release that stuff. I don't know, but maybe she'll be able to find out some stuff. Very interesting. I hope that happens. Let's take a break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Cam is an interesting fellow, I have to tell you, folks. He's constantly coming up with new things that we talk about before we decide to record a show. And sometimes we will literally have 15 to 20 different subjects that we have to think about. We don't know which ones to go, what order we want to do them. Sometimes we literally just throw a dart. We're like, let's go with that one. And so there's constantly times where he's surprising me with new data, because sometimes I'm always like, I'm pretty familiar with the paranormal. I'm pretty familiar with most of these stories, as most of you listeners.
Oh, yeah.
And every once in a while, though, he'll come to me with something I've never quite heard of. And I love those, because I'm like, what? I've never heard of this. And that's my favorite ones, because, it, you know, I love to learn new things, just like I like to try a new recipe. And I think today he's got one that you folks probably are not that familiar with. Cam, can you tell us a little more?
Oh, I'm going to jump into this one right here. This was one of those ones that I can't say I've been sitting on it. I remember reading about it, and then it's one of those ones like you talk about, you forget about, and then it just dawned on me. I don't remember where I even saw this little clip thing from, and I was like, oh, I've been wanting to talk about this. So this goes back into some stuff we've talked about, folks, and I guess it starts out with, can a place be evil? And I'm not talking about the people of the area, or the government of the country, or even the history of that place. No, what I'm talking about is the actual place itself, the soil, the water, or even the air of this place. Is it possible that evil and darkness can inject itself into some energy form that we may not understand, and with that dark energy, turn a place sinister? And could that sinister energy have some sort of intelligence of its own, like that reported with shadow people or even demonic possession? Now, I know it sounds like the ramblings of a madman with crazy ideas of conspiracy, and it very well could be, but we've covered many locations throughout the world that have a definite air of strangeness and unexplained phenomenon tied to them. Now, one of these places that I'm talking about is a river that's found in the bush of Australia. Now, for years now, it's been the origin of mysterious disappearances, brutal, bizarre murders, cryptic creatures, and even ghostly phenomena. The river that I'm talking about is the Forked Stick, or Meeting of the Waters River in Aboriginal language, better known to the locals as the Namoi River. Now, this beautiful flowing jewel is about 440 miles long and home to such things as the Murray Cod, a large fish that can exceed 40 kilos. And also found there is the Namoi snapping turtle, which is unique because it's a species only found on this river. And of course, the platypus, everyone's favorite egg-laying mammal. It's this idyllic little river that evil hides in. You see, in 1908, on a grassy riverbank one early summer's night, two mates set up camp at a very idyllic spot on the Namoi River, not far from a small town in northwestern New South Wales called Wee Waa. was Harry Johnson and Stanley Williams. They were two good friends out for a nice evening camping, and something terrible happened. Now, we will all never truly know what transpired that night, but one thing for sure is that an extremely violent and bloody act took place there, and that act left a dark and evil mark on this quiet river. It could be due to money owed or money taken. It could be due to drinking and misunderstandings, but we'll never know. But what we do know is on the 26th of December in 1908 was reported that there was an arrest of a man named Stanley Williams. And in the morning bulletin, it had this: a man has been arrested in connection with the murder of a man whose body was found in the Namoy River near Weewa. He was brought before the police court of Pilaga and remained for 8 days. He was charged as Stanley Williams. Now, Harry Johnson would be pulled from the river, his badly decomposed body anchored down in the waters of that river by an iron bar. Now, on January 11th, 1909, the Sydney Morning Herald ran a testimony from a Dr. Willis. It's very graphic, as he said the body was exposed to the air for probably 4 or 5 days. The body I saw may have been dead only about a fortnight. Senior Sergeant Sheridan placed a hammer in my hands this morning. I fitted it to the hole in the skull of the murdered man and found that it fitted exactly into the hole punched there in the fracture behind the ear. Richard Sheridan, senior sergeant of the police in Weewa, said that the brake of a van or wagonette was strapped to the back of the body. The body appeared to be that of a young man, about 5'6" or 5'10" in height, and of slight build. The flesh from the head, feet, and hands had all disappeared. The rest was in a fairly good state of preservation. The brake block bar, which was strapped to the body, was painted dark green with white lining. The bar weighed 30 pounds and measured 5'9" long. The following day, he proceeded to Briglow Creek, 12 miles out, in company with Sub-Inspector Butler, where they saw James Hogan and had a conversation with him. Witnesses went to the stable and saw an ordinary four-wheeled vehicle. He noticed the body and hood had recently been repaired and painted black, and the undercarriage was painted a dark green, faded, and yes, had white lines on it. It had not recently been painted. Underneath, there was no brake bar on it, but on examining the undercarriage, witnesses could see that it had been recently removed. The bolts, which kept the bar in position, were there and looked as if something had been unscrewed or used to unscrew them. He subsequently compared the paint of the brake bar and undercarriage and found them exactly the same shade and lining, and the van was outside the court that day on December 20th in company with the sub and the two trackers. Witness went to Myall Val Reserve about 7 miles up the river and on the northern bank, found a campsite which appeared to have been recently occupied. The doctor found a pair of men's blue dungaree trousers, two pairs of men's socks, and in some little area there, he found some thistle brush about 8 yards away, a pair of blucher boots, which appeared to have been worn a short time before. Hidden behind a log about 30 yards from camp, he found a connecting rod and lever of the brake, which had recently been painted black, with the exception of the inside lever. The distance from the camp to the river was easily 30 yards, and the camp couldn't be seen from the road on either side of the river. Witnesses afterwards found the brake bar and connecting rod and the lever and fitted the van and everything together. Now, in June of 1910, Mr. Williams was convicted of a lesser charge of manslaughter and sentenced to 10 years hard labor. But the story of the death of Mr. Johnson would never end with Williams' conviction. See, there was a writer who had been following the murder for months and even wrote an article that was published in the Border Morning Mail and Riverina Times in June of 1910, and he wrote this, that at one of the prettiest spots on the Namoi River, a terrible tragedy was enacted some months ago when a man named Harry Johnson met his death at the hands of his mate Stanley Williams, who was now undergoing a sentence of penal servitude in connection with this crime. The fella had heard of these strange tales taking place after the murder also, so he went to stay with a friend, a Mr. Thomas Underwood, who lived about a mile and a half from the murder scene, and was investigating a number of these strange happenings associated with the campsite and experienced by both locals and visitors that were completely unaware of the story of murder. Now, Mr. Underwood came across one such man named Arthur Pruitt, a well-known Nabree local and respected man of the tribe, and he relayed to Mr. Underwood that he had previously camped unknowingly near the scene, and his pair of wagonette horses showed and decided aversion to the locality, so much so that when night came, they forcibly broke away from their tethers and left the neighborhood. Now, after passing a night of fearful sleeplessness, for which he could not in any way account, Mr. Pruitt spent the early part of the next day searching for his horses, which he found some several miles away. Now, the following week, Pruitt claimed to have again passed through the area. This time, he asked Mr. Underwood's permission to camp near his homestead and leave the horses in his paddock, as they had absolutely refused to go on to the point near the river. Now, Pruitt also told Underwood that he did not relish the idea of again experiencing the uneasiness of mind which had attended him when he last camped there. Now, Pruitt had two sons, and they too dealt with the issue of missing horses after inadvertently visiting this campsite for some fishing. They were driving an old quiet horse attached to a spring cart and reached their fishing ground safely, Mr. Pruitt said, and as soon as night came on, however, the old horse, which had never been known to do the like before, smashed the winkers and galloped homeward in a perfect frenzy of snorting fear, leaving the boys to pull the cart home themselves. The researcher visited the riverside campsite with Mr. Underwood to see for himself the very spot where Johnson had been murdered. And he wrote that it was an ideal camping ground, beautifully situated and well grassed. But signs of the violence that took place months earlier remained. And he wrote the exact position of the victim's tent was pointed out by Mr. Underwood beneath a handsome, well-grown Peruvian, the largest of a clump of similar trees which shelter the spot on the southwestern side. The position of the victim's head appeared to have been close to the tree, as he was supposed to be in the tent at the time of the tragedy. And after the crime had been discovered, a patch of ground about half the length of the dead man's body was found to have been saturated with blood. The tree was also dyed with blood, and even now, the dark, sinister stain can be detected on the back of the tree trunk close to the ground. And although the grass grew very beautifully and 3 inches long all around the tree on all three sides, the ground was completely bare where the victim had been slain. But he also reported this, that dozens of strangers have camped there knowing nothing about this tragedy, and each one had a distressing experience and has moved onward to more congenial quarters. Without exception, all persons camping there at night with horses have been hunting around the neighboring county for them the next day, no matter what good camp horses they may have been before. So far as feed is concerned, the whole of the point is better grassed than any other portion on the reserve, but as soon as night falls, all stock leaves there at once, and horses being particularly anxious to get away. He even found that it wasn't only horses that could feel a sense of evil hiding along this stretch of river, but people were reporting creepy and terrifying experiences as well. And according to this fella, there's an article of a woman that had a night experience that she wouldn't soon forget, and he wrote that only a few weeks ago, a man and his wife, strangers to this district, unyoked their horses near the spot and arranged to camp for the night. Soon after dark, the horses were missing, and although the night the woman went nearly raving mad, declaring in her screams of terror that she was surrounded by and struggling in a sea of human blood. The poor man really thought his wife had lost her mind, and in the gray dawn made off to the nearest house he could find, which happened to be a Miss McKenzie. And here he told the experience of the night, stating that he was sure his wife was going to be very ill and asking for assistance. After being questioned as to where his camp was situated, the man was then told of the tragedy, and he lost no time in vacating that dreaded spot. Immediately after leaving the place, his wife began to recover, and by nightfall on the succeeding day, she was almost in her normal state of health, being utterly at a loss to account for her frenzy of the previous evening. Another fellow, whom had no clue of the murder and new to the area, camped at the same spot, and he later stated that he would refuse all the gold of the empire rather than to go through a similar experience again. He said that all night long, some unseen power was trying to pull the bedclothes off his bunk, and that terrifying agitation was going on in the river just below him, where he was sensed to find out that the body of Johnson was, with the heavy brake bar attached to it, being hurled down a steep bank into the river. And in 1934, the river would be the location of a strange and unusual unsolved experience. In the Sydney Morning Herald on Friday, 23rd of April, 1934, there was an explanation of the disappearance of a stock and station agent by the man of George Knott. He had come from the village there, Pilliga, in New South Wales. He had gone out for a long drive along the river about 10 a.m. the last time he'd been seen and just simply vanished. And after about a week of being missing, Knott's car was discovered at the bottom of the river, yet the body nowhere to be found. And there were some bizarre clues left behind that baffled and troubled police, because you see, in the rear compartment of the car, they found some bullet shells, all being .22 caliber, the short type. Yet no real significance was attached to them, because Knott had always been a keen hunter and sportsman who was known for going on frequent shooting expeditions. But a hole was found in the hood of the car. At first, it seemed to be a large caliber bullet, which seemed as a very important clue. But the size of the hole exactly corresponded to that of a stud on the hood. So it was later determined that as the hood of the car had been folded back due to the river current, that it had banged against the stud and formed a hole. But the exterior of the car showed no other signs of damage. Now, the interior of the vehicle, well, that didn't help matters any either. There were no signs of struggle, except for some broken fittings in the front of the compartment, but this was not seen as any kind of definitive evidence. There was also no signs of blood in the car, and while the river could have possibly easily washed it away, the article did state that wet blood might have been washed away when the car was driven into the river, but blood dries quickly, and even after a very short time, it would have left an indelible stain. The only other clue left behind was that of a set of missing tools. So police set up a camp along the Namoi River and systematically dragged the bottom for a mile. But the body was never located, and interviews by dozens of locals living in the area turned up nothing, as no one reported hearing or seeing anything suspicious. And this vanishing of George Knott has never been solved, his body never found. And the Sydney Morning Herald, also dated back in 1973 of March, talks about a mysterious sudden appearance of large amounts of dead fish in the river near the cotton farming community of, you guessed it, Wee Waa. In this case, though, the dead fish appeared steadily for over a week, and it was also reported that any birds that were seen feeding upon these fish were also found dead as well. Now, health authorities tried, looked into the matter, but could find no cause of death or any reason why the birds should die from eating these fish. It was finally speculated that this phenomenon was perhaps linked to the overuse of some insecticides in the area, because there was a large caterpillar plague that was destroying cotton crops. But this was non-conclusive. It's not clear if this sudden mass fish die-off had anything to do with this strange phenomenon, but I don't think it should be overlooked. There have been reported stories of bunyips, mysterious murders, ghostly activity, and the overall feeling of dread and despair still hanging over the murder site, along with even more mysterious disappearances. And we'll never know the truth behind what is lingering there on this river, or if it will ever go away. But I think we can all agree that there is something truly evil that was left behind on the shores of the Namoi River.
Man, that is incredible. What do you think?
I still think, and I still stand by the fact that I believe, and I know a lot of people don't, I believe that there can be something left behind when something tragic happens. We've done the shows about the battlefields in Gettysburg. We've done the tales of murder and things in these areas, and I still believe that there is a lot of areas on this planet that have had some hard tragedy, that there still lingers some bad energy, something that's going on there. And another thing that drew me to this story was the use of water. We always talk about the water and the disappearances in water, and it's strange because it almost seems like, is water some sort of vessel in itself that holds this energy, be it good or be it bad? I don't know, but it does seem like there are some very strange ties that go along with that.
Yeah, I agree, man. It's very interesting to me.
Yes.
These stories, I mean, because there's so, like you're saying, there's so many that are so similar that it almost seems like there has to be something going on.
Well, and it's always, you get with these animals that seem to notice something, seem to feel something that goes on. I don't know, man. It's almost like they can sense, like they always joke about, you never trust a person that doesn't like a dog, but I always trust a dog that doesn't like a person.
Yeah.
You almost get that feeling when you find these places like this. Like if animals refuse to go. We did the whole story of Mel's Hole, where dogs and cattle and stuff would go nowhere near it. You know, you always seem like, look, if there's a place, folks, that your pets don't want to go, I would dare say don't go. Mm. I would almost say, look, take their word for it. You don't got to be so adventurous. There's other adventures elsewhere that's a lot safer. Don't dabble. Just take their word for it. Go someplace that's a little sunnier.
But how many places are there, though, on planet Earth that people don't know about and they just decide to go camping or something like that, and then it turns out, oh, crap, this is one of those places?
Well, it makes me think that that's what can answer a lot of the places where things are built, that they have some bad experiences on, where things like that, is maybe these areas are holding it. We don't know what happened 100, 200, 1,000 years before, but maybe that's always been.
It's funny that you bring that up, because I think that all the time. You'll see like a brand new building, I mean brand spanking new, go in, and then say like over the course of 10 years, there'll be like 20 different businesses go in there. And you're like, I don't get it, man. It's prime real estate. It's in a good spot. It's a new building. It looks fine.
Yeah.
Why is no business there ever seem to be able to hold its doors open for more than like 8 months, right?
Yeah.
You've seen that. I'm sure everybody's seen that in their town. Or like you're talking about, you know, this car is just a lemon.
Yeah.
It just seems like there's certain things.
Just something about it.
Right? It is weird. I love those kind of stories. Very cool. Well, let's take a break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Man, And we are back, and I have something cool I want to share with you folks. And I say it's something cool in a lighthearted manner. I don't want you to take this wrong. I don't want you to think of me as a sorry SOB, even though you're probably going to, because I kind of laughed at this. Now, look, I know it's kids. I shouldn't laugh, but it just caught me funny at the time. I'm not laughing now, but you're going to get a kick out of this. This has actually come from CBS 12 dinner in Florida. It's Florida man's up to no good again, folks. A fire-breathing performance at a high school pep rally in Delray Beach sends 8 to the hospital. That's right, folks, 8. There was a Florida man down there trying to do some fire-breathing routine in the high school, wielding a baton, and he himself suffered burns, and so did some kids. Apparently, the performer caught fire.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Burst into flames. Now, one person, it says, identified as Ricky Charles, was taken to the hospital by helicopter, but he's in good condition. And this happened back in March. And they're talking about there was a 15-year-old that had to have some breathing treatments and all that. So it sounds like there was a flash on him. But it does sound to me like the performer burst into flames. So the reason I wanted to cover this, folks, is this. If you don't know what... Exactly. If you don't know what you're doing, just tell them you have to pass. Be like, look, man, I can't really. Look, it's one thing to kind of lie a little bit on your resume. Don't go into there saying, look, man, I can. I'm a fire breather.
Guys can't do that, though. Their ego always gets in the way. You never try to teach like a girl or a kid something. They're usually like real susceptible to it. But guys are like, get out of the way, bro. I got this.
Yeah, right?
Just get out of the way. I know what I'm doing.
You're exactly right. When I used to work up there at the archery shop all those years ago, you would have children or women. Women were the best to teach because they've got no bad habits and they listen to you. They'll be like, okay, you know, they're willing to learn. The worst is when you get a guy that thinks he shot before and he really shoots like crap.
You ain't telling him nothing.
You can't teach him nothing. There's a guy that would go in there and be like, I'm a fire breather, man. I got an MMA record of 118-0.
A one-upper.
I juggle chainsaws. Yeah.
Like your buddy Carlos. That's my favorite.
That's
just the one-uppers. No matter what story you have, they're always like, oh, yeah, well, my uncle did it this way. You know?
Right. Everybody must have been full grown and living by themselves when they were 6 years old.
Yeah.
Look, aside from all that joking, folks, I want to say thank you to a couple of people. Kyle does too.
Yeah, me too, man.
J.W. Buckley, thank you for the wooden shark.
That's pretty cool.
It's cool. It's disturbing, but I keep it right up. It's on the shelf right here. And the lovely and talented Miss Janet Walker, thank you for the box of goodies you sent me and Kyle. We have some baked goods here, folks. Like, I needed to have any more reason to eat. I can make myself sick on eating these.
Oh, it's amazing.
She's an amazing chef.
I've already eaten half the box. Yeah.
She a chef or a baker or I don't know what you would. Just amazing woman. Janet, thank you so much. Both of y'all, thank you so much for the stuff you sent us. It was great. Y'all are great. Y'all are really too nice to us. I mean, everything we have, this is a family. And everybody's got all these fans. We just have a family. That's all this is, a big family of listeners. You folks are great.
Yeah, we would not be able to do what we're doing if it wasn't for the help and the support of all you listeners. And if you'd like to help out the show even more, do not forget that we do an extra show every week called Expanded Perspectives Elite. And if you join Expanded Perspectives Elite, you'll get an additional episode every Thursday, Friday, somewhere in that range. Also, you'll have access to our entire back catalog. And if you sign up now, you're going to get to hear all these. You've been missing out on some shows. Recently, we did one on more upright canine sightings. We did, if you're like leprechauns, like we talked about in the beginning of the show, we did one about leprechauns and gnomes and trolls on St. Patrick's Day. We did Robert the Doll. We did more holes. And we even had a special Graylian X and Elite X episode with Lyle Blackburn and Nick Redfern all here in studio. I know a lot of you saw that on Facebook and Instagram and things. You can hear them in studio. You're missing out, folks, and it's only $5 a month. So join up now. You'll really be helping out the show. If you want to sign up, you go to our website, expandedperspectives.com. Follow the Elite tab. Click on there. And there's also instructions in the frequently asked questions part that'll tell you how to sign up on your iPhone or your Android phone or your tablet or desktop. And if you have any problems, you can always email me or Cam and we can get that going. If you'd like to call the show and give us a story, the number's 817-945-3828. Or you can just email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Now, I know lots of people have left us messages recently. I've been going through them, cataloging them, separating them into different categories, and we'll be playing those soon. But Cam?
Yes.
The weather is finally starting to break. It's starting to get nice out. It's starting to feel like early summer around here. I love it. My grass is growing like crazy. So I've been mowing a lot more than I like to. But the weather right now, it's perfect. This time of year in Texas, it's not too hot. It's about 75 degrees. Unfortunately, that only lasts for about, 4 weeks?
If that long.
And then it'll be 95. Yeah.
If that long, yeah.
But it is starting to change, which means more fishing for you, more outdoor activities for me and the kids. I think we're going to start trying to dig up some fossils.
Now you're talking.
I've been really looking at this group on Facebook that we're in, and man, it's really inspired me to try to get outside. What do you got planned for the week?
You know what? To be outside as much as possible. I'm going to do some more work.
Get a little vitamin D, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can't help. You know what? There's something else I want to touch on before we wrap up today.
Sure.
That really kind of bummed me out. Look, I got bummed out when I saw that China had passed away, because when I was a kid, dude, I was a big fan of wrestling, and I remember when all that was on. She wasn't even much older than me. I didn't know all that, but I remember seeing her and all that stuff. But the thing that hit me the most, brother, was Prince.
Yeah, man.
Well, we lost Prince, man, because my wife is a huge Prince fan. I'm a huge Prince fan. If you don't like Prince, man, I just don't know if you and I can be friends. I love Prince. He's a guitar playing machine, pulling the ladies. Man, the ladies. Great Prince performer. Like, man, what is up?
I'm not much of a karaoke singer, but if somebody forces me to do it, my go-to song is Purple Rain.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
I love Purple Rain. Every song. I love it. Raspberry Beret.
We're losing a lot of musicians.
This year has really sucked for the loss of musicians. Yeah, so man. Prince, my friend, rest in peace.
Rest in peace. If you also about musicians, people email the show all the time about who does our music. Our music is performed by a man named Derek Vincent Smith. He's also called Pretty Lights. It's not really a band. It's him. It's him and his computer, yeah, and his synthesizer. And you can go to prettylightsmusic.com. There's links to it in the show notes. And he provides us all of our music graciously. So go check them out. For everybody, please stay out of trouble this week. Cam, especially you.
I need the help.
Ryan, take care. For Inner Traditions Book, Warwick Books, Pretty Lights, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hill.
Peace.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows you don't want to sacrifice reliability for savings. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select LG appliances and purchase two or three select major appliances to get an additional 10% off. Save big on LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.